Salesforce. So anyhow, great to be here. I'd like to introduce my incredible guest, Daniel. Daniel's going to be talking about his journey. He's been in Mexico. He's been in the U.S. He's in Palo Alto, California with Gino Bank. And I'd like to bring him on board. Thanks a lot. Hi, Daniel. How are you?
Dear Gary, how are you? It's a pleasure to be here with you in your show. It's an honor. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's great. So tell me a little bit about it. So where did you grow up? Where are you from originally?
I was born and raised in Mexico City. In Mexico, we are called Chilango, right? Basically, in the capital. Very, very happy. I have three siblings. My parents are still with me, thank God. So yeah, very, very happy.
So you went to school in Mexico, right? And then, you were an engineer. You went from an engineer and then you went to iPaid. Where's iPaid located?
Well, actually it's Ipade, but that's okay. It's, I think, still the only kind of Ivy League related MBA program that we have in Mexico City.
Daniel, Ipade, yeah?
Ipade, yes, Ipade, okay, a business school. So it's kind of related with Harvard school, and at least it's the same, you know, methodology. You go inside a room full of talented minds and you just study cases, right? It's you argument 600 companies along the 2 years that the program lasted. And yeah, that was an exciting MBA. And during that program, we were brought to the Silicon Valley in 2014, I believe, into an immersion program to Silicon Valley. And then I met Peter Diamandis from Singularity University. I mean, back then, Peter Diamandis was the VP of engineering of Google. And he introduces us to Bitcoin. So just an anecdote from...
Well, that's great. Did you get into it early?
Yes. I was a participant in 2015, March 2015. And yeah, that was an exciting moment.
Because how much was Bitcoin at the time?
$200.
How, really? Yeah. Now, I hope you loaded up on it. Great. I hope you loaded up on this stuff.
Well, kind of, but then I spend it in groceries.
Oh, there you go. Well, you know, it's like me. I mean, I bought some Bitcoin and Ethereum and I sold. I'm actually glad I sold because I sold at the top of the market. So it was actually really good.
That's good. That's good.
But okay, so you did that. You went through that. Now, how in the world did you go from being you were a communication electronics engineer, but then you went to Sun Microsystems. Was that your first job?
It was then a little bit, obviously, like we have to jump back to 2002. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was going to be 2001 when I was going to be admitted at Sun Microsystems, but it was 9/11, right? Very near 9/11. But the long story short, I managed to go inside Sun Microsystems. I started my professional career as a Unix engineer, like all the Solaris kind of world. And back then, I finished as a storage area network. I was specialized on storage. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, just as an anecdote, we were beginning.
Well, it seems like a long time ago, doesn't it now?
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Because it was like literally a long time ago. It's 20 years now.
It's hard to believe, isn't it? You know, I had lunch with Scott McNeely.
Oh, my God.
And a couple of years ago, we had lunch in Palo Alto. And he's quite a character. He was quite a interest. I remember he said to me, he said, always go to areas you fear the most because you're going to learn the most. He actually told me a long time ago. And I mentioned it to him. I said, you know, you were right on target because you got to swim in the opposite direction of the market. You know, when people are afraid, that's the time to go because there's opportunity. And I never forget that. And I told him that. And, he liked that. So it was interesting. Imagine taking a little company called Stanford University Network with Bechtel, Scheim, and Vinod and group, and turn it into this incredible company. And then you could see it kind of come down, right? It went from the top to kind of moving, you know, backwards, and then sold to Oracle. So you did that. You were at Sun, but then you went to, what made you decide to go to Emerson Network Power? What was that about?
Well, that was more a relationship now as an entrepreneur. So in 2004, I decided to open my first company. It's called United IT Consultants.
Mm-hmm.
It's still on service. I am not longer the CEO. The CEO now is led by a very talented woman called Jeanette Cano. Mm-hmm. So I did like three partnership programs with Emerson, with Ericsson, and Oracle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of those were like partner programs, but I was already acting as the CEO of United IT Consultants.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first company. And then I founded Converged IT to have the new kind of virtual servers, like very based on virtual machines, like from VMware, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't turn out. We were too soon for the Mexican market. So that company didn't prosper. But that's one of the key aspects, right? Like you just start learning what works and what doesn't, right? I would say.
Well, I mean, that's it. You go out and try it. But then how did you, I got a question for you. You went to Oak Financial Software Corp and you were only there for 4 months. What made you decide to, first of all, to do architecture work? Did you just come in and then say, I don't like this thing, I'm getting out?
No, I invested in Oak. Back in those days, my wife and I created a fund and we invested in about 17 companies.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are still alive, so that's good. Only two have just closed. But Oak was very special to me, very dear to me. One, because of the entrepreneur, was another Mexican based on a professor from Notre Dame, PhD in statistics, I believe. Mm-hmm. But Jesus had the vision to try to fix the remittances, right? So mm-hmm. he founded Chapulín. Mm-hmm. Chapulín, it's literally a moneygram in your pocket, right? It was very... back in those days, 2015, 2017, mm-hmm. or 16, was the innovation was to be an app, right, for the Mexican kind of ecosystem. But he wanted to introduce like cryptocurrencies back then. I believe was a good moment. Never took the decision because of regulatory frameworks, and that's why I got out. Like say, okay, so if there's not going to be crypto here, I have very few things to add. And we decided just to finish that.
No, that's amazing. So then in Kiosko, you were the founder there, your financial inclusion project. How did you come up with that? What was the idea behind that?
That was my third kind of company. Obviously, it didn't work out, but it was a wallet designed for blue-collar workers,
mm-hmm.
specifically for ladies that do the housekeeping here in California or in the U.S., mm-hmm. or people who, you know, make household-related kind of jobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that was a try fast, fail fast kind of thing. We realized that cash was king or is still king in that sector. Didn't work out. But the good news is that we only spent like $25,000.
Well, that's good.
It was good in those.
You still had your Bitcoin money. That was great, right?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was not Bitcoin money. So it was, and also not in from any investor. So it was bootstrapped by me. Just learned. I met Adeo Resi in those days in the Founders Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Great mentor. He helped us to realize pretty quickly that this was going nowhere. And the best advice he gave us is like, hey, you need to shut this down and just rethinking and try it later, maybe. Because we also thought that the community was ready for the crypto kind of boom, right? And
Are we
that is not
ready though, Daniel, even now? Do you think we're ready today? I mean, look at the market. It's kind of kooky, right? I don't know about you, but it's like I've been in enough of these ups and downs over the last 35 plus years. I've seen the ins and outs. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of weird. It's a what happened to it, right? What happened to this, to wind in the sails?
I think this year is very particular because of the global crisis, right? So it's a lot of noise, and it's very, very hard to see what's going on. Sorry for the background noise, is the gardener. If
I
you
was
can
gonna say, I think you have a motorcycle there with you.
hear.
I
Yeah, I was like driving my
was
Mustang.
gonna say, I mean, you never know, right? You got a virtual background. Would have been a new one, but I would have bought into it.
Exactly. No, thank you for that. So sorry about that. No, the thing is that for me, the signal is still there, right? And the signal for me is the amount of new engineers, female and male engineers, I mean, like regardless, that are coming to the space. I'm truly inspired by the young people believing in Web3, believing in the decentralized technologies. They don't know, no longer wants to work or aspire to work for the big five, right? For Apple, for Google, for Microsoft, and so on and so forth. So that's, for me, that's a clear thing that crypto is here to stay, that we are still building, still early. But 2023 will be, in my kind of predictions, a great year for crypto once we kind of get rid of all this noise that is, in my opinion, coming from the outside world.
No, you're right about the noise. The other thing is, there were so many wild things that happened with the cryptocurrency. Coming up with these cryptocurrencies were just, a flash in the pan. And so people, there's one thing about Bitcoin and Ethereum. There's another thing about some of the other cryptos that, people invested and lost a lot of money on. So, it's kind of like every time, and you've seen this out in the valley, we come up with an iteration. I know in the dot-com bubble, the same thing. All kinds of companies came out, like pets.com. And then they
Exactly.
went down quickly, right? Webvan. They went down quickly. Not bad ideas, by the way. Not, some good ideas, but they were either too early or the market just clobbered them. So I think, we're in that space with the crypto side. I mean, this digital transformation's upon us, and it's surely an easy way to be able to move money around, to be able to take care of goods. And then you talk about things like smart contracts and a blockchain. It's an incredible world. So it's just a matter of time. It's not, maybe not right this second, but it's a matter of time, right? So tell us a little bit about what the Jino Bank, what you're doing today, about your decentralized wallet that's used for and your DNA saliva kick to be able to use users to establish ownership and control of the genomic data sets, correct?
That is correct, Gary. No, thank you very much for the opportunity. So everything started with the NFTs, right? So the first time I heard about the NFTs was back in 2017. And those were very, very early days for NFTs. Literally, obviously, I was inspired by my personal story as well, because my son in those days was but diagnosed with a rare disease. And it is called Glanzmann thrombocytopenia. It's a rare blood phenomena that is very similar to hemophilia, but it's not hemophilia. And it's a mutation in two genes in the 17 chromosome. So I knew literally very basic stuff about DNA. So I turned into from fintech space to genomics. And to be more precise, not strictly in genomics, but in data governance of genomics. So I saw like how can I help? Because you obviously, as a parent, you learn very, very fast. You have the clock ticking, right? And there's many problems in the ecosystem of genomics, or many opportunities, right? Better said. The first one is that Back in those days, it was almost like very, very rare to get a prescription for sequencing your DNA, right? We literally have to go through at least 10 or 12 doctors, different specialties, to get to that, like saying, hey, why don't we sequence your DNA, right? But the very specific thing is that at the same time, in parallel, we were experiencing CryptoKitties. So CryptoKitties, I don't know if you remember that game, is still a thing, right? It was the first game that involved a digital genome from the character, right? In this case, a kitty. So it was a 256-bit genome that was really the tokenization asset. So if you tokenize the genetic map of the cat, you would be able to put it inside an algorithm and then see how the cat looks, right? In the DNA space,
Sounds like a the fly.
exactly. So there is like your genotype and there is your phenotype, right? So our genotype is our map, right? The genetic map, the letters, and the phenotype is obviously how we look, right, from the exterior. So it was, for me, it was like super clear that this was going to happen with human genetic maps, like saying, hey, it makes sense to tokenize the data and somehow represent rights at that time, right?
So
Actually,
tell us a little bit about what do you mean by tokenizing? Because some people think about tokens and they're confused with crypto. So tell us a little bit about what you mean by tokenizing.
of course. So tokenization is back in the time. The most famous tokenization, I think, transaction before crypto is credit cards, right? So few people know that whenever you put your credit card into the POS, in the point of sale, when you buy groceries or you pay your bill at the restaurant, literally you scan your credit card and it gets tokenized. The tokenization process is like a data capsule that encrypts the data of your credit card, and it's sent to the network, right? In this case, Visa or MasterCard networks. Those were like the two most, or still the most famous networks of tokenization that we are aware of. The fact is that these are centralized tokens, right? This is proprietary, like data capsules from Visa and MasterCard, right? They invented the protocol. And you cannot take those tokens out of that network. They are only like they have meaning only if they are in that context, right? And the mission is really, really simple, and we obviously experimented, is just to see if you can get an approved transaction or not. And let me make a small parenthesis here, because a lot of people compares like how fast Visa and MasterCard are versus Bitcoin, and that is a wrong approach, because Visa and MasterCard, by the way, is only a network of pending approvals, right? You just get an approval that somehow the system is telling you, hey, you have the enough balance, right? But that doesn't mean that the transaction is finalized or final. It finalizes 2 or 3 days after. So if we really compare the 10 minutes final transaction from Bitcoin from the 2 to 3 days of Visa and MasterCard are really, really slow. But anyhow, that's another topic we can, but this is the tokenization process. This is like literally credit cards were tokenized in a centralized version. Now, what changes now is that these tokens can be minted by regular, let's say, developers, right? And you can use decentralized networks which are not controlled by any corporation or any centralized institute, right? And that's the the fundamental thing.
Wow, that's and how's your traction? Where are you guys with traction?
Well, today, I mean, this is just to show the audience, this is our tokenization kind of asset, right? So this is a saliva too, because we started with NFTs, but NFTs were so in the mind, right? It's so ethereal, right?
Yeah.
So we said, hey, we need something physical to show the world what you can do. So we took from our friends, we're customers from DNA Genotech, and we took their saliva kit and we paired it with a wallet, right? So if you scan this QR code, you will be able to create a wallet and create a secure data room only for your biosample that is only controlled by the NFT token holder, right? So it's a governance mechanism in a pair biosample basis. That being said, so this system right now is connected to 30 laboratories and genetic testing companies. We have three genetic testing companies now using it. We have approximately 500 DNA kind of related, and we have 330,000 other bioassets that goes from COVID-19 to paternity tests to HIV tests and so on and so forth. So because now we support the HL7 protocol, which it's a
What is
very, very
that?
laboratory test.
What is
So
HL7?
when you do a blood work, you go to a machine like si similar to a sequencer, but this is a different machine. So most of the machines right now talk on HL7 protocol. Right, this is a world standard to communicate laboratory machines among them. So what we do is we tokenize that output in HL7 protocol to notarize the results and protect it against tampering, because many of these tests have legal implications. The one that I would always put first is the paternity test, right? You can imagine all sorts of legal implications for an altered paternity test,
Yeah,
right?
you just don't want to
It
get it
happens
wrong,
a
that's
lot.
for sure.
And happens a lot. So,
I agree.
correct. So what we do is we convert this into tokens and we notarize the output of the test.
Oh,
And
that's fantastic.
oh, thank you.
And so
Thank
tell me a little bit about, so we're coming up to the top of the show. We've got a couple of minutes left. So, in summary, can you tell us in summary what your feelings are? What's going to happen in terms of technologies like yours for the over the next couple of years? And then what's the best way for people to get a hold of you, to reach you?
Thank you, Gary. So what is next, I think, is still building. I mean, we're still early. Like, for instance, we're now introducing the laboratories to the metaverse. We call this the Genoverse, right? For us, it's a very, very bold kind of movement, because the scientific community waits. I mean, maybe it's the one of the final kind of communities to adopt certain like cutting edge technologies, right? And this is just because they are very conservative, and there's obviously obvious reasons for them to do that. That being said, like we have like an example of a researcher that I admire him. He's in a wheelchair. He's suffering from a rare disease, and he's super like emotional about the Genoverse, because now he can create an avatar, right? He can be in the virtual world walking, talking to his patients, talking to the community members that they are their his donors, right, of biosamples, and be free. So this is the kind of stories that I see.
It's like Avatar, kind of. You know what I mean? It's like Avatar, and you know, where you he was crippled, and then he became. I hear you. I mean, exactly. It opened up the world for sure. It's going to open up the world. So I get that. So it's going to open up the world. And how are we going to respond to that?
Well, my mission, my vision is, as long as you can take care of people's privacy, people's right to own and control their bioassets or biodata, according to the local regulations, will be fine. Because, yeah, that is true. There are other companies that, I'm going to say this with a lot of respect, they seem like animes, like not serious about the managing the personal information about the people, and that concerns me. But we are privacy first kind of mission. Our bio NFT has been awarded because it's based on Article 7 of GDPR, which talks about consent. And as long as we take care of the consent of people and people is aware of where is their data, transparency, accountability, and so on and so forth, I believe we are in a safe zone.
No, that's great. So what's the best way, Daniel, for people to get it, reach out to you? LinkedIn, Facebook, email?
Please reach to me on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I'm very active on Twitter. My email is daniel@genovang.io. It's very, very simple. And more than happy to talk about any potential. We are raising money if somebody's interested. We're trying to close our round soon. So get in touch if you want to get on board the bio NFTs and the Genoverse.
Now, thank you, Daniel. And thanks to my audience for taking time out of your busy schedule one more time. I'm Gary Fowler, and I am the host of GSD Presents Silicon Valley AI and Tech. Stay tuned for another exciting edition coming to you on Thursday. Be safe, be happy, and stay healthy, and I'll see you soon. Take care of yourself. Thanks, Daniel. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for having me.